Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. It being late of a Friday afternoon, of course, the final tax bill is just coming out now. And for the second time this week, here's the tagline. It is all over, I think, except the shouting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 15th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is a rare week when the last meeting of the outgoing chair of the Federal Reserve is the second most important economic story of the week. But hey, taxes. We'll get to both of those with Catherine Rampell. She's from The Washington Post. Rachel Abrams is at The New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey there.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and the tax bill, which is all but done and coming up for a vote next week. It seems to me we're engaged in an experiment here, right, where the Republican Party says these tax cuts are going to pay for themselves and boost growth. And mainline economists are saying, yeah, I don't know.
It's not even just the liberal economists or the centrist economists. It's even right-leaning tax organizations like the Tax Foundation that have said, no, this bill will not generate nearly enough growth to pay for itself. So, yes, there is sort of economists on one side, tax experts on that same side, and then the Republican Party on the other side, of course.
Rachel, with Senator Corker saying this afternoon that he is going to vote for the bill, Marco Rubio from Florida also saying he's going to vote for the bill, it does seem that this is a done deal, yes?
It's certain the Republicans certainly want it to be so. They really want to get something done before the holidays. Obviously, Doug Jones' win in Alabama means that if they were to delay it any further, they could face they'd lose their already slim margin to get this passed. And so they have definitely said that they want to get something to the president, I believe, by the end of December.
By the end of the in fact, even by next week, right? Because we have the continuing resolution. Catherine, let me get you back to the idea of the cost of this thing. As we know, it's $1.5 trillion that was authorized in deficit spending to finance these tax cuts. We don't know whether or how this bill is going to stick to its $1.5 trillion mandate, right?
Well, the short answer is through gimmicks, right? They're doing a lot of things, or at least they've been talking about doing a lot of things that would make the bill look like it costs less than it actually does. Things like having various parts of the bill, particularly on the individual side, expire so that even if Republicans claim that they will be extended, like the doubling of the standard deduction for American households, for example, even if they say that it will continue, it's not being scored as continuing, right? So that makes the overall cost of the bill look a little bit lower. But you bring up a very excellent question, which is, how are they going to pay for this thing? I mean, they've given themselves $1.5 trillion to run with, and it's not clear that they can even stay within that very large box.
So, Rachel, riddle me this. With this bill adding to the deficit as it does, and Republicans traditionally opposed to increasing the deficit, with this bill being as unpopular as it is amongst all categories of voters, why is this the Republican priority?
Well, I think this is what they see as the one way they can give President Trump a legislative win during the beginning of his first, I don't even know how many days we are in his office, but he needs a legislative win. Republican donors have basically said to the GOP, look, if you can't get something done, don't even bother calling us. They need to show that the Republican-controlled Congress, that a Republican president can get something done. We obviously saw a massive failure with their efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare. We haven't really heard, as Catherine and I were talking before the show, we haven't really seen much in terms of infrastructure, which was a big thing that Trump spoke about on the campaign trail. So this is something that they really need to pass to show people that they can do something.
Well, Catherine, so I didn't know you guys talked before the show. That's very interesting to me. I learn something every day on this program. talking about infrastructure and talking about Paul Ryan, he's the guy, the Speaker of the House, who wants to take care of entitlement reform. With Doug Jones's win in Alabama, does the road get easier or harder for Republicans now that moderates have some more oomph in the Senate?
Harder, particularly on entitlement reform, right? Yeah. Their margin has been narrowed, so they do have to appeal to the moderates, such as they are, although there's a lot of debate right now about whether there are any moderates left within the Republican Party, given the votes thus far on the tax legislation. I think infrastructure is a completely different ballgame in that I don't expect that to be on the agenda seriously at all. I think the only person who cares about it at all is Trump, and he doesn't seem to care enough about it to even have a proposal available. I don't think McConnell cares. I don't think Paul Ryan cares. And Trump has not really thrown his weight around a whole lot on that issue, and I don't think he really has the patience or the attention span, or he hasn't shown either of those things thus far anyway, to really double down and say, hey, this should be a priority, guys.
We shall see what we shall see. Rachel Abrams at the New York Times and Catherine Rampell at the Washington Post. Thank you, too.
Thanks,
Thank
Kai.
You.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, I don't know whether traders are taking this into account, but the, hey, there's going to be a corporate tax cut rally only has another couple of days to run before it's a done deal. Then they're going to have to find something else. Until then, though, they are dancing like nobody's watching. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Overnight, anyway, there was no immediate change to the internet after the vote yesterday by the Federal Communications Commission to get rid of Obama-era net neutrality rules, or a little bit more than 2 years old. Also, in federal regulatory affairs yesterday, a similar story over at the National Labor Relations Board. Some Obama-era rules that unions liked and companies didn't have gone away. So putting party and politics to the side here for just a second, what's going on? Because there is some fairly substantial regulatory uncertainty happening with big chunks of the American economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us what's at stake.
Those new rules from the National Labor Relations Board will make it harder to organize unions and hold parent companies accountable for their franchises. Employment attorney Denise Kaiser at law firm Ballard Spahr.
The recent decisions, they are changing very significantly labor and employment law.
She says the pro-labor Obama-era rules in turn reversed pro-employer Bush administration rules. Regulatory ping-pong, that's what a top Comcast exec called it, and he was complaining about the FCC's net neutrality decision that favors his company. So this zigzagging must be a pain for businesses. Economist Douglas Holtz Aiken at the American Action Forum explains how we got here.
We've seen a fair amount of congressional dysfunction, and more and more gets done by the executive branch. That means more and more of what businesses care about is subject to this game.
Consider, for instance, investments in telecom under Trump's FCC.
Going from 4G to 5G is going to cost a lot of money, and your ability to recoup that investment depends fundamentally on the kind of rules the FCC has in place.
Patrick McLaughlin studies regulation at George Mason University's Mercatus Center.
In Congress, there have been proposals requiring agencies to release at least the big rules long in advance before they take any action. That could help with long-term planning.
Now, Congress could pass laws on net neutrality and the like, take the regulatory ping-pong paddles away from the executive's partisan agencies and commissions. But Congress has been a bit gridlocked lately. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the regulatory economy, the Department of Homeland Security has announced plans to reverse an Obama administration immigration rule. This one's for the spouses of H-1B visa holders, the visas that skilled workers get, often to work in high tech. DHS gave notice yesterday that it's going to get rid of a rule that lets some of those spouses get jobs of their own. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains that change.
Back in 2015, Homeland Security under President Obama said giving these spouses the right to work made perfect sense. Their rule applies to spouses of skilled workers who already have been preliminarily approved for a green card. They can work once their spouse actually gets the green card, but that can take ages, given the limited number awarded each year.
People from India who are receiving their green cards today waited 10 years to receive them.
David Beer with the Cato Institute. He thinks the backlog has grown so big, that number could climb to 50 years for new applicants.
you're talking about potentially a half a century of waiting for a green card and your spouse can't work. It doesn't require any kind of rocket science to figure out that a lot of people are going to start leaving the country.
That's why Beer says this rule change would be a big deal for the roughly 40,000 spouses who would be eligible to work under it each year. Homeland Security said in a statement the proposed rule change stems from President Trump's Buy American, Hire American executive order. Sarah Pierce with the Migration Policy Institute says it's true spouses aren't limited in the types of jobs they can take.
This employment authorization isn't regulated in any sense. There's no labor market test to ensure that there's a need for foreign nationals in this area.
But Pierce also thinks that many of these workers are likely to have skills similar to their spouses, skills the U.S. economy really needs. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If regulations are your thing, by the way, and they should be because those last two stories, for one thing. But anyway, check out season two of our podcast. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This week's episode is about the regulations that brought OxyContin to market and helped get millions of people addicted to opioids. You can download it. It's at marketplace.org as well. One of the few things I know about fashion is that Diane von Furstenberg made her name and her company with the wrap dress. The dress still works. The company, though, is in some trouble. Jonathan Saunders, DVF's first chief creative officer, left the company today after just 18 months on the job. His two predecessors didn't last much longer, and there hasn't been a CEO for more than a year. The rest of the fashion world is under some duress as well. Elizabeth Holmes writes about fashion and style. We got her, as I think you will be able to hear, at the airport on her way out of town for the holidays. Elizabeth, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai.
18 months does not sound like a long time for Jonathan Saunders to have been running a major fashion house.
He is the latest in a remarkable string of departures in the high fashion world. Yes, it's a very quick turnaround.
Why is DVS specifically, I mean, they haven't had a CEO since 2016, but why is the fashion world having such a tough time right now?
Well, you know, what remains to be seen is, you know, is this good for fashion, this constant churn that we're experiencing? And I think in the pro column is definitely this constant demand for newness, something that's new. They want something that's fresh. They want something that gives people reason to, you know, open their wallets and buy something that they don't have in their closet. And a new name at a label definitely does that. The downside here is that to shoppers, it also telegraphs something when someone leaves, right? That it's not working. People don't leave because it's working. It also makes shoppers kind of uncertain, and they think, wait a minute, you know, this is expensive stuff. Should I hold off on buying from this brand for a little bit until, you know, they kind of figure it out? So, you know, with people like Diane or Ralph Lauren or Oscar de la Renta, you know, finding somebody to replace them when they are the name and the face, that is a really difficult thing. And, you know, obviously there was something that was not going well with Jonathan, and they parted ways.
You know, when this story came up at our meeting this morning, not everybody, but the people who know fashion around the table said, listen, it's really hard for them right now. They have to meet all these new demands, and it's a constantly changing environment. And I said, look, it's changing for all of us, man. We've all got to do this.
I mean, yes, absolutely. I think the fashion world has the added pressure of, you know, there's a lot of places you can spend your money right now. Yeah. Fashion is competing with tech. You know, if you spent $1,000 on the new iPhone, you know, that's perhaps a designer handbag that you're not going to buy. So, you know, I think fashion is feeling competition from a lot of different places right now, coupled with, I should add, the long lead times. You know, they're working on cycles that are, you know, a year out. And so it's sort of, they're trying to speed up and keep up with the times. And I think they're feeling the pressure.
Yeah, just on that speed thing, how much of a problem is it for these houses that, you know, they show something on the runway and 2.5 days later you can get it, you know, not necessarily at Ross Dress for Less, but probably Target or something?
Well, certainly at Zara. I mean, I think that continues to be a problem. You know, the luxury world says, you know, they need to build that anticipation and they need that proper time, you know, to get the magazine editorials and to get on the racks and things like that. I think the shopper is increasingly less patient with that, that they see something, they get excited about it, and if they're going to buy it, they want to buy it right away. Yeah. And I think there's a reckoning that still is coming.
Elizabeth Holmes writes on fashion and style. She is on her way out for the holidays. You can probably hear right there. So I'm going to let you go get your plane. Thanks a lot, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
Beach Babe XOX.
Sick Man 9483.
Banana Laser 874.
What was your AOL screen name, huh? Come on, fess up. First, though, let's do the numbers. On this Friday, the Dow up 143 points, a half percent, 24,651. Have you heard there's going to be a tax cut? The NASDAQ added 80 points, 1 1/10%, 69.36. Traders sure have. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 9 1/10%, 26.75. Maybe Tuesday, Wednesday-ish is when it's going to be done. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 1.3%, the NASDAQ up 1.4%, the S&P 500 up 0.9%. May not be news to tell you that Costco is doing well. Thank you very much. You've been there lately? Aisles are packed. It beat expectations this quarter, giving its shares a holiday bump up 3 3/10% today. Bonds basically flat. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note stayed at 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Lost, perhaps, in the rough and tumble of the tax bill and the looming government funding deadline next Friday, for those who've lost track, is the deadline for Congress to reauthorize the National Flood Insurance Program. It is also next Friday, as it happens, and also a deadline that's been kicked down the road a couple of times already and could get kicked again. That's because it's a mess. The flood insurance program is billions in debt. It's inconsistent and unwieldy, and it sometimes does more long-term harm than short-term good. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Last year, when Hurricane Matthew was spinning havoc in the Atlantic, Virginia Wasserberg's house was spared gale force winds, but the hurricane brought storm surge into her home.
The entire first floor of the home suffered about 18 inches of flood water.
She lost family mementos, things that have no price tag, but also plenty of things that do.
Hot water heater, range, refrigerator, washer, dryer, all furniture.
More than $100,000 in damage. She and her husband rebuilt their home using a combination of personal savings, loans, and payouts from the policy they had through the National Flood Insurance Program. Why didn't they just move instead?
Well, if you have a mortgage, like my husband and I do, and your house floods and you don't rebuild, you cannot collect the money from the flood insurance program. And so then you will have to foreclose on the home and take the risk of running bankruptcy.
Since the storm, she's made it her mission to educate the public on flood risk in Virginia Beach, especially since she's learned her house will likely flood again. The NFIP grants up to $250,000 in coverage. It's long been criticized for how it incentivizes homeowners to rebuild in vulnerable areas. From a taxpayer point of view,
the problem is not that they rebuild, but the problem is that they don't
face actuarially fair prices for insurance.
Michael Greenstone teaches economics at the University of Chicago. He says the NFIP forces people in floodplains to buy insurance and offers them premiums that are too low to cover the program's actual costs. Then, when disaster hits, taxpayers make up the gap. There have been efforts to end subsidies and impose market rates. In 2012, the program stepped up rate increases for repeatedly flooded homes, but it got a lot of pushback. Jeff Slegelmelch is with the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University.
People couldn't keep up with the payments, as well as they couldn't sell their house. They couldn't transfer that wealth to anyone, which, you know, affected their own economic mobility.
2 years later, Congress said never mind. It repealed many of the changes. Jimmy Grandy is with the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. He says politicians from flood-prone areas have little to gain from forcing homeowners to pay more.
There's not a lot of political courage being on display here in Washington. There are some people and some efforts and some packages that would reform the program in a meaningful manner, but they tend to never win the day.
The House has passed a new attempt at flood insurance reform. Among other things, it again proposes rate hikes for houses that flood repeatedly. Jerry Howard, CEO of the National Association of Home Builders, says rate hikes have to be gradual because the market for private flood insurance just isn't there yet.
It's going to take time to build up the private sector presence in the marketplace.
But even with a $10,000 cap on annual premiums, the proposed bill is a no-go for Virginia Wasserberg.
It actually raises the price of my flood insurance premium to being unaffordable for me at the price of my mortgage.
Regardless of whether or not the Senate keeps that in their version of insurance reform, she and her family are done.
We have made the decision that coastal living is not for us anymore.
They put their house up for sale in February. In 10 months, they've only had a few people show interest. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Today is a somber day for a lot of children of the 1980s and 90s. One of the defining technologies of those times is shutting down for good. AOL Instant Messenger, AIM sometimes, is signing off forever. When it launched in 1997, AIM changed the way millions of people communicated online, and it laid the foundation for the nearly inescapable 24/7 world of social media that we have today. Marketplace's Rima Kreis looks back at the chat service and what it meant to so many people, including her.
There's a box stashed under my bed full of high school memories, including this bright orange binder. On the front, scribbled in pencil, it reads, "Warning, this is not school-related." Inside are pages and pages of top-secret conversations I had on AOL Instant Messenger. Gossip, flirting, and those tortured goodbyes. I was 16, and it showed.
Man, it's getting late.
Yeah, and I have to go. My dad has been, like, bugging me.
Oh, man, okay. I guess we'll see each other tomorrow in history.
Okay, good night. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, good night.
Good night, bye.
Bye. Smiley face.
At its peak in the early 2000s, AIM had 36 million active users, many of them angst-ridden teenagers with screen names like...
Beach Babe XOX.
Sick Man, 9483.
Banana Laser 874.
Chanel Check 16.
Soccer Dude 58.
Soccer Blondie 535.
I was Sweet and Sour 435. And like Soccer Dude 58, Banana Laser 874, and most of my generation, I haven't logged on to AIM in years. Then there's this guy who's chatted with his friends on AIM nearly every day for the past 20 years. His screen name?
Oh, Appleman. I also have Barry.
Barry Appleman. You could say he was one of AIM's earliest adopters. He helped invent it. Appleman worked in development at AOL back in the 90s. He was the guy behind the original buddy list. You know, the thing that showed which of your friends were online and ready to chat.
I sort of put my thoughts on paper at some point and said, you know, we really need to do this as a standalone product for the internet.
So Appleman, along with a small team, started designing an instant messaging service. AOL's response?
They didn't know about it.
What?
We built this in secret, in development, telling no one.
Appleman says back then, a free messaging service, as in no subscription fee, wasn't considered a sound business idea. AOL did not embrace it.
There are very few people willing to, you know, say, oh, we should embrace this and toss all that old stuff out that's making us money.
Appleman's team tried to find ways to monetize the service, but advertising never really took off. Meanwhile, AOL was starting what would be its own long decline.
The handwriting that AIM would be dead was on the wall for many, many years.
But like so many tech pioneers, AIM helped set the stage for the companies that would eventually surpass it, says Karen North. She's a professor of digital social media at the University of Southern California.
They had news tickers and stock tickers. They had the ability to talk or do voice before Skype. They had file sharing for music.
AIM also deserves some credit for social media's emotional shorthand.
Little acronyms like LOL to emojis and profiles.
Instant messaging was like the prep course for expressing yourself online. It's where soccer dude 58, a.k.a. Patrick Duplessis, asked out his first girlfriend in elementary school.
I was just so excited by her response because she said yes that I printed out the conversation and brought it to school and showed all of my friends.
It's why no one in Beach Babe XOX's house could get a phone call in edgewise. Dial-up was the thing back then, and Gabrielle Carullo was always logged on.
Oh my God, all day long. Literally, all day.
And it's where Kate Sella, XOXO Dance 9312, mastered the art of the away message.
I feel like a little break in my heart. Like childhood lost or something.
Me too. This is Sweet and Sour 435, signing off.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the caveat that I am just as excited to see The Last Jedi as the next guy, but the good people at Dole, the fruit and vegetable company, they may have taken it perhaps a bit too far. Their Unite for a Healthy Galaxy licensing campaign, which we should note started a couple of years ago, has, with The Last Jedi, put Star Wars characters and branding on more than 3 billion servings of fresh produce. Yes, great for the kids, but does Disney really need that money? All right, we got to go. The Dow up about 143 points today. NASDAQ up 81.1%. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 0.9%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I am Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.